rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to the pod from The Times and The Sunday Times. It's been a quiet week since we last spoke, hasn't it? Owen Farrell still hitting players in the head. Eddie Jones is picking the greenest Wallaby squad you've ever seen. Roman and Tomac, Jack Van Portfleet are out of the World Cup. England and Wales served up an absolute stinker of a test match on Saturday. But then, thank God, France and Scotland came up smelling of roses. So there's loads of us to get into today. And with fly halves dropping left, right and centre, who better to chat to us about it all than Stuart Barnes? Barnsley, how are you?
I'm all right. I'm very grateful that you mentioned my first book, Smelling of Roses. Books about the World Cup popping through my post all over the place. So nice to get the reminder in.
Yeah, absolutely. And also on the ruck, we welcome back our man in Ireland. Peter O'Reilly joins us, our Irish Sunday Times rugby correspondent. Peter, a calmer week from Ireland, but all steps up now with England coming to Dublin. How are you guys over there thinking about all of this?
Hi, Will. Thanks for having me. Hi, Barnsley. Yeah, we are excited at the prospect of having England over this coming Saturday, which is probably, it's a send-off for the first choice Ireland team. We're expecting a full house at the Aviva Stadium. And there's a bit of sense of excitement growing here, definitely. Yeah.
What you haven't said there is, and a victory by 50 points.
Definitely haven't said that.
So, look, we'll do the usual God and Goddess of the Week stuff, talk about England-Wales, France-Scotland matches, as well as look forward to England going to Ireland and Wales hosting South Africa and all sorts else. But why don't we start with a bit of breaking news? We are the news pod, I suppose, by the journalists, after all. So, before we started recording on Monday morning, Roman Ntamack has been ruled out of the World Cup. He went off for France against Scotland in St Etienne on Saturday night, and it's now been confirmed he's out the tournament with a cruciate knee ligament injury. We might widen this out, Barnsley, to the sort of curse or whatever else you'd call it with these fly halves. But just on that to start with, that's a hell of a blow for France, isn't it? Losing Ntamack, their fly half.
For a large part of his international career, I've always thought arguably the most elegant fly half in the world, but not the most efficient. The last 12 months, he has really picked up his game. And the fact that he's club mates with the world's finest player, Antoine Dupont, helps. You know, he scored a lovely gliding try, which was stamped with Ntamack all over. So, yes, of course, he's a lovely player to watch. And despite what Steve Borthwick seems to think, there's nothing wrong with beauty in the game of rugby. So that's a massive blow. But from France's perspective, in Mathieu Jalibert, they've had a man who for a long time has been vying with him to be France's number one. And in Antoine Hastoy, Ronan O'Gara's pick from Pau to become star man for La Rochelle at 10. No, France still have riches at 10. But yeah, overall, you know, when I saw that and heard that news about Ntamack, you just thought, damn, because he's a lovely player to watch.
I think that's the thing, Peter, isn't it, with some of these injuries. I mean, we've had, obviously, Johnny Sexton's ban and Owen Farrell's impending ban, so those ones are sort of their fault. But when it comes to these injuries, it is a shame, isn't it, when you come to a World Cup and you think, oh, some of the best players are not going to be there.
Yeah, I'm reminded, with England coming here this weekend, I'm reminded of 2011 when poor David Wallace was injured on the eve of departure for a World Cup. He took a heavy hit from Manitou Langi. And it's the awful aspect or the awful side of these warm-up tests that this sort of thing can happen. If you remember the top 14 final only a couple of months ago, it was a pretty ordinary game between La Rochelle and Toulouse, but it was lit up at the last moment by Ntamack. And he had the capacity to light up the World Cup. But as Barnsley says, I can't think of two more talented backups. Another 24-year-old in Jalibert, he's a class player, and Hastoy will push him close. So Entomac will come again. He's only 24, but it's a shame, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. So while we've got you there, Peter, where are we with the Johnny Sexton thing? Clearly he can't play yet, but there's been a bit of internal matches and things like that. And where are they looking to back him up? Who's going to be playing on Saturday, do you think, for Ireland against England at 10?
Yeah, I'm expecting Ross Byrne to start. There was a feeling towards the end of the domestic season that with Munster winning the URC and Jack Crowley being a star of the show, that he might leapfrog Ross Byrne into number two. But it's a bit soon for that to happen. Andy Farrell has invested quite a lot in Ross Byrne. He's a much more seasoned professional 10. He played in all five of the Six Nations games he was involved in. So I'm expecting him to start. And it's also, there's a personal journey involved there because his first start in a green shirt, this is Ross Byrne I'm talking about, his first start for Ireland was in Twickenham 4 years ago when Joe Schmidt threw him to the wolves and England put 50 points on Ireland that day. And it was a hint that maybe Ireland had gone over the hill a little bit, that they peaked the previous year. So it's an opportunity for him to make a statement. We know that obviously Sexton is going to be available. And the plan, I would imagine, is for him to start against Romania, who look, it's a very easy opener for Ireland in Bordeaux. Romania had 60 points put on them by Georgia at the weekend, I think. So that would be the plan, that Sexton comes back in for the opener. They have won between this game on Saturday and the start of the World Cup. They have a game against Samoa in Bayonne, which allows them to spend a week at their World Cup base in Tours. So, but this is the sort of the final send-off game, as I mentioned earlier on. And I'm expecting Ross Byrne to start and Jack Crowley to come off the bench.
Yeah, OK. So, Barnsley, we'll get on to the Owen Farrell thing properly in a second. But just on all these fly halves, so we've got Entomac out the World Cup, Jalibert possibly the number two there. Farrell almost certainly going to be banned for a few matches of that World Cup. But George Ford, the number two there. Johnny Sexton there. We've got a few options for Ireland, as Peter's been talking about. Andre Pollard's injured, so Manny Lubbock's been playing 10 and actually is the only kind of out-and-out 10 in the South Africa squad at the moment. And then in Australia, Quade Cooper looked like he could have had a chance, but it was dropped and they've gone with Carter Gordon. So seems like we're at sixes and sevens at 10.
Yeah, radical times. I mean, New Zealand will be sitting there quietly with Richie Moana, solid as you come, thinking, that's not so bad, that's not so bad. Of the big guns, they are the only one now who are comfortable in having a 10 who's been running their show for some time. Now, it's very interesting. Carter Gordon, he does some lovely things, but he doesn't look like he's got the feel to control a World Cup yet. I think the Ireland issue is very interesting. I was listening carefully to what Peter was saying there. I felt that we saw the limitations of Ross Byrne against England in the Grand Slam game. He's been asked basically to be a no-frills Johnny Sexton. They're trying to make sure that the Irish system isn't broken, but he doesn't, I don't think, have the capacity under pressure to do that. And I think if he is Ireland's fly half in the big games, there's a very big weakness. Sexton's fitness now becomes overwhelmingly important. And I must say, I think Andy Farrell's done a magnificent job in Ireland, but I've seen so much of Crawley. I know that it's quite early, but I'd have just said, hey, it's England at home, then, you know, they're a poor team, they're probably Romania sort of league. Let's just play Crawley in that match and give him another 60, 70 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as if they're playing a strong team.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, right, we did promise that we would get onto England-Wales as much as some of us are trying to forget it. But there's a lot to talk about and unpack from it. So why don't we start with there, move on to the Irish stuff and then cover a bit more on France, Scotland and everything else and end with the God or Goddess of the Week. OK, Stuart, both of us were at Twickenham on Saturday evening to our shame, maybe. Well, we'll cover them through thick and thin anyway. But where do we start? We've probably got to start with Owen Farrell and his red card. We both wrote about it in the Times on Monday for readers who've picked up the paper. What were your initial thoughts on it? A bad tackle and he deserves a ban, I suppose.
You know, he's a serial illegal shoulder hitter. There's no argument about it. I would really like to see the RFU and Richard Smith not go in and battle. I'd like to see a bit of decency and morality and say, we've had enough, give us 6 weeks and we'll settle for that. And I'd like to see the authorities, if England actually do go in and argue the case and try and get it cut down, do what they seem to do. It's a weird way to have justice, but well, you didn't accept that you were a naughty boy and you haven't been apologetic, therefore, and you argued against it, so we're going to go 10 weeks. I'd like to see, you know, if you argue against this, it could go even further. And having said it, Farrell hasn't, I came round to him last year, but I was foolhardy. I was seduced by his Saracens form. And I've forgotten that club and country are two different things. And he hasn't played a really strong game at fly half or centre for England for a long time. For whatever reason, when he wears the white shirt, he can't maintain his cool and composure. The smile you see with Saracens disappears. He becomes a warrior. And as I said today, warriors are great in one ways for sport. But when your warrior's got number 10 on his back, there are even more negatives than there are positives. So, you know, I looked at the way he was playing. I looked at the predictability with which he kicked one way and passed the other and thought, Michael Checker will have him for toast if that really is how England are going to play. And I thought, as a kid, Ford was a better fly half than Farrell. As an adult, he's a better fly half than Farrell. And Farrell's a major personality. And I think the issue is, do you say if he gets 6 weeks, you take him out of the squad? Because I think he makes it quite hard for some of the younger players to breathe and find their feet. And I'm thinking of Ford starting, and if England need to chase a game, which given the fact they don't have a great pack, they might have to do, then it would help Marcus Smith as well. So I think there's a big issue. If he's going to be out for 6 weeks, for example, which would leave you with the possibility of him playing in the final, then you just say, let's do it. Let's leave him.
I think this is becoming my catchphrase on the podcast, but just to do the admin on these things. So he gets he got his yellow card for his hit on Tame Basham. Tame Basham failed an HIA, although I've seen that Warren Gatland has said he's slightly questioning how he failed that HIA because I think he was distracted by the television in the changing room, which sounds a bit of an odd thing to say, but there you go. So it then got upgraded on the new bunker system, which essentially a second TMO looks at it and decides whether it should have been a red. They correctly decided that it was a red card. So now we go into Richard Smith, as you mentioned, Stuart Barnes, the KC, the King's Council, the top silk that England have, who once got Dave Attwood off a ban in Australia where he stamped on someone on a technicality, basically, because I think by the tour agreement it was meant to say that the citing commissioner should have been neutral and he turned out to be Australian. So it's a bit like one of those of like, oh, you weren't wearing your seatbelt or something. So he's got a history with doing well for England players. But I think, as you say, Barnsley, he's going to have a hell of a job this time. So what happens now is that Farrell's having his hearing on Tuesday. We may or may not get the verdict that exact day. Sometimes they take a long time. But he's facing a six-week ban, which is the mid-range. It always starts there if you hit someone in the face these days, which Farrell did with his right shoulder. And then it's, yeah, whether any mitigations are taken into account, which some of them come from a guilty plea, timely, good conduct at the hearing, all those sorts of things that frustrate people. Saying hello, wearing a nice suit. I remember Joe Marler once saying a few years ago, he was like, I can't believe it, I turned up with a bright orange Mohican and I didn't get the good conduct tick in the box kind of thing. So yeah, we will see. If he is banned for 6 weeks, he'll then miss, clearly, Ireland away this Saturday, Fiji at home the next week, and then all four of the pool games at the World Cup. So at that point, it's a massive decision for Borthwick whether to take him or not. And then if it's 4 weeks, 5 weeks, I think a lot of people are up in arms because Farrell does have a long history. He's never been sent off for England, but he has had a ban in 2016 for a tackle on Dan Robson that was a couple of weeks. He had a worse one in 2020 on Charlie Atkinson that people remember, another Wasps game where he knocked the young fly half out.
Well, that was a savage. That was awful.
And he got 5 weeks for that. And then more recently, he got a ban in January, which people remember, because he then attended what we now call tackle school to get a week off his ban, and therefore he was available for Steve Borthwick's first game in the Six Nations. And one thing I noted in my piece today was that at the time, England was so keen to tell us that Kevin Sinfel was so good at rehabilitating offenders that World Rugby actually used the footage he went through with Jasper Visser at Leicester in the sort of tackle school thing. World Rugby used that as their blueprint for the videos that coaches should send in to try and get people off a ban. So I think the fundamental point with Farrell here is that he's not learning. I counted up, he's played 347 professional matches, 107 of them have been England tests, and he's done it again, Stuart. Like, it's a massive frustration for England that, and I'm sure for him, that here's a guy who's a talented rugby player who's got several opportunities to learn how to tackle safely and is not doing it.
No, also, you see, the defence will only talk about the number of times how infrequently he's been sent off. But that still doesn't mean that referees don't get it horrendously wrong. And if you think to a South Africa game with Esterhazen, which was the most clear and identical shot to the one we saw on Saturday.
2018, this is.
The same series against Australia. An identical shot that rocked the ball loose from a second row's hand, and England held on and won the game. And he was a hero for getting away with it. But this is the point. It's not about getting away with it. It's about the sport saying, are we just talking about health and safety, or are we going to do something? And if Owen Farrell doesn't get the minimum mid-range, the minimum, because his track record, it doesn't matter what anyone says, his track record is awful. I've watched thousands and thousands of minutes, hundreds of hours of Farrell playing, and too often we see this. He's one of the most famous rugby players in the world. So, ergo, how does World Rugby really say we are a body that is trying to make sure that we don't have dangerous play when one of the most famous protagonists, England captain, England are spending all their intellectual firepower trying to get him off, and he's not even playing very well at 10. In the interest of the game, it would be good if we got quite a big ban here.
So if we widen it out to the game itself, Stuart, clearly England came back and actually won the game, and Steve Borthwick was keen to point out that showed a lot of character. I don't know if you'd agree with me that I thought that a show of defiance and character against the 10th best team in the world is hardly a sort of kite mark of quality that England fans should be running down Witton Road afterwards celebrating. But did the Farrell thing kind of overshadow how desperately poor England were, particularly in that first half?
Well, first of all, and I'm sure Peter will agree, these games are not simply about the results. They're about so much more. And Steve Borthwick saying that it shows character he's diverting from the Farrell situation, which he thinks is more substantially bad news for England than I certainly do. And two, he's diverting from the fact that England have hardly played any rugby since he has taken over, and they were terrible in Cardiff and they were worse. Other thing you have to say, Wales are rated 10th in the world, but this, you've got to remember, was nowhere near a Welsh full team.
No, not at all.
Much nearer an England full team.
The most experienced team England have ever put out, 23-man squad.
Mind you, having said that, all this talk about experience, these are blokes who have been playing for the last 3 years or so when England, they've been amassing caps while England have just been getting worse and worse. So we just sometimes, things are said and we just go along with it. The reality is that, experience or not, it was a rookie Welsh team, and England, they won because Wales in the end wilted in the set piece and they lost all former leadership. I'd also say the one positive is George Ford came on, and much like he did in 2020 in Paris, when Farrell had lost the plot completely, he just grabbed the game, he put the ball in the right places, he kicked well, he varied his game, and he made England look a halfway intelligent team when they had looked fairly dunce-like for most of the game.
Yeah, I mean, we did mention it at the top when we talked about all the fly halves, but England are unbelievably fortunate, really, to have an 83 cap man of the quality of George Ford to come in now, don't they? I mean, and also, if they want other leaders, Courtney Laws, you'd think, would be a pretty good shout to be captain now.
No, he would have been a pretty good shout to be my captain a few years ago. He did a good job. The players liked him. Mm. The players relaxed with him, and he was just getting into the captaincy. He gets injured, and then he's lost it again to Owen Farrell. Owen Farrell is a real follow me type, and it can be inspiring. I don't dispute that, but it can also be very hard if you are in a transitional team and you are trying to change the way you play and you're trying to bring younger players in. Sometimes big personalities make things very hard for younger players. And I think we've been seeing this happen with England.
Talking of younger players, we must mention poor old Jack Van Portfleet. I think it was 32 minutes in, he tripped over Ollie Lawrence, and he now, England have confirmed on Monday as we're recording that he requires surgery on his ankle, so that means he's out of the World Cup. And Alex Mitchell from Northampton Saints is coming to replace him. I don't know, Stuart, if that will help speed England up. I mean, they've still got Danny Kerr and Ben Youngs, clearly the two most capped England scrum halves of all time, but there'll be quite a few England fans pleased to see Mitchell get his shot.
Yeah, I think, first of all, you have to say there are a lot. I felt that Mitchell and Spencer should have been in it, and I think England made a right haulix of their scrum half selection. But the first emotion has to be sympathy. He's a young guy, and he wasn't having the greatest game, but, you know, when you get ruled out of the World Cup, and how old is he? 20?
22, Jack Van Portfleet, 22. Yeah. And Mitchell's, you know, 26.
My overwhelming emotion is sympathy. And, you know, you can think about what it means, and maybe it will help them with Mitchell coming in. But I think, you know, within such a short span of the news breaking, all you can say is send sympathy to the bloke and his family and friends. It's rotten.
Yeah, poor guy. So, Peter, obviously, this England team that we don't quite know what it is or how it's trying to play are coming to play Ireland this weekend. We've had a week off their warm-up games, haven't they? Is it a weird situation, I don't know, for Irish journalists and Irish supporters and others going, England are terrible and Ireland should beat them, Ireland are number one team in the world? It all feels a bit weird this year for Irish fans, does it? I don't know.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, my impression of England, I suppose, is based largely on the Grand Slam game, where Ireland feel that they didn't play particularly well. They wondered whether it was stage fright, you know, they were on the verge of achieving something significant, or whether it was England actually being difficult to play against. And England are difficult to play against. I think, you know, when you watch them play on Saturday, you're trying to figure out what exactly, when they have the ball, what are they trying to do with it? And, you know, they seem at a very early stage of their development. It's like when you're starting off, you'll let's get the things that are simple to get right. We'll get those sorted out. And after that, we'll move on to perhaps something a little bit more sophisticated. But I don't know how often, I mean, you probably have the stats, Will, but how often have the same 9, 10, 12, 13 played for England in the last couple of years? It seems like there's constant chopping and changing. So as Barnsley mentions there, being able to put George Ford in there for a sequence of games now is actually definitely a silver lining. You can build some sort of a rhythm, right? He can achieve some sort of a rhythm. And as you say, I remember him playing really well for England at Lansdowne Road or at the Aviva in 2015 when he was only a kid. And afterwards, Sexton commenting on, God, this guy's got such a high ceiling. So he gets an opportunity now. You can build some rhythm. And I just noticed that there's the small things, like whenever England won a turnover penalty or something like that, they celebrated like they won the game. It's like they look like a team that are determined to feel good about themselves. Mm. And I also have a suspicion that Owen Farrell is central to that. That's just looking from the outside in. My expectation is that, you know, I love Barnsley's idealism, but my expectation is that it's going to be a 6-week entry point, as we said, and he's going to go in and apologise, and it'll go down to 5 or 4. That's the reality of it. And so he's going to miss the Argentina game, but he'll be around for the knockouts. And England, though you might argue don't deserve it, they're going to stroll into the quarterfinals. And from the other side of the draw, that's what Irish supporters are probably feeling a bit jealous about, is that we'd love to be where England are, just on that side of the pool.
I know. I was talking about this with someone else the other day, and it's brutal, isn't it? Because imagine if you were to swap, let's say, Ireland and England to the other side of the draw. England might pick a completely different squad and say, well, it's a bit of a shot to nothing. We're with the top 4 or 5 teams in the world. We're not where we think we need to be. And Ireland, you just go, wow, it's opened up completely with that side of the draw. But it feels almost cruel for Ireland this time, doesn't it? That you go in number one team in the world on a Grand Slam, and in order to get just through to a semi-final, you've got to play well or beat South Africa and then definitely beat one of France or New Zealand. Like, how are the Irish camp kind of, how are they at the moment?
Yeah. They'll rationalize that by saying, well, we're going to have to beat New Zealand or France at some stage to win a World Cup. You know, they have reframed the narrative. It's always been about getting to our, you know, Ireland getting to their first, to the last four for the first time. So Farrell has reshaped it by saying, we're going there to win the World Cup. So it doesn't matter really when we play New Zealand or France, which look like being potential, you know, the probable quarterfinalists for whoever the top two that come out of this group. I'm phrasing my words carefully there because I watched Scotland for the last 2 weeks, and you know, I mentioned earlier the Romania game being a bit of an, you know, it'll be a bit of a turkey shoot, but I'd say Ireland will go into that game thinking about points differential because there's every possibility that it's going to be a fascinating pool. You can use that as a from a positive point of view if you're the World Cup organisers, but you know, there's a possibility that Scotland, Ireland and South Africa are going to trip over each other and it'll come down to points difference, that sort of thing. So that's the way Farrell will look at it is just by saying, yeah, that's what he'll tell his players. Listen, don't so much think about trying to get to the semi-final. Let's think about going the whole hog here.
What are you sensing from them, Peter, with the way they're approaching it? It sounds like the few dispatches that we've heard, you guys have been closer to it than us. They're playing with the ball a bit more and mentioning that a lot. I mean, it sounded like 4 years ago, the sort of overarching detail of Joe Schmidt kind of was too much by the end. Whereas this time, is it a bit more relaxed, do you think, the build-up to this World Cup?
Well, Schmidt and David Nusafora, the performance director, they made a decision at the start of 2019. They had do we change our game plan? Do we evolve? And trying to move beyond that sort of that Schmidt blueprint. And they decided to keep going with plan A, but just do it better. And I know that the players who were involved that summer, you know, at this time of the year, 4 years ago, felt that they hadn't worked on their skills enough, that it was all about fitness and all about army camps and all that team building stuff. So they have gone for three warm-up games and a training spin against Portugal last week. And they've used the ball at every opportunity. And Farrell has also mentioned the fact that they've had to evolve. So by that, I mean, I'm guessing he's talking about a different attack shapes so that the opposition video analysts are made to work a little bit harder. So he's got about four guys who have been to three World Cups already. Murray, Sexton, Earls, Keane Healy as well. So that's a bunch of people who have plenty of sort of intellectual capital. They know what worked before and what didn't work before. Farrell himself was involved as defence coach for the last World Cup cycle. So they've gone for one game fewer. Everything that they've done has involved a ball. And I think that sounds clever. And they're determined to not be exactly the same team that won the Grand Slam a few months ago. So yeah, if they can achieve that and they can keep feeling about as good about themselves as they apparently do, I think they can do something special at this World Cup. But there's always a rider, and I suppose it involves Johnny Sexton, funnily enough. And it probably involves Andrew Porter and Tiger Furlong being able to go the distance as well.
Just on the Sexton one, do you get the sense that they're dealing with the kind of circus around all of that quite well? Because he's so influential, like even more so than Owen Farrell with England. There was just never a question that he would not go to the World Cup, even if he was banned for more games. That he's so influential and so important and basically like a coach on the field and around the place, isn't he? But there is a lot around him not being available for some of these games, isn't there?
Well, it might work out to be a blessing because Sexton has a history of kind of being airdropped into the middle of tournaments, even though he hasn't played much rugby and surviving physically. Now he's 38 now, so it's going to get it's getting tougher and tougher. But some people are looking at the three game ban, the misconduct ban, as a blessing because it means he'll definitely get to France anyway. It's interesting, the guy who chaired the panel for his misconduct cases is also on the is one of the Aussies who's on the Owen Farrell case actually, but unlike, say, Scotland, who go in with their first games against South Africa, having Romania first up allows him to have a bit of a hit out in the first game, allows Sexton to ease his way into the tournament. I would imagine he'll try and get a few minutes in the second game against Tonga, maybe off the bench, and then start against South Africa in game three. That would be the ideal situation. There's a two-week gap between that game and Scotland, because, as you know, the pool section has been extended for welfare reasons and player safety. So it could work out okay for him. You know, the important thing is that you, your playmaker and your captain and your most important player can be there for the knockout stages, assuming that Ireland get there. And that's the plan. But he is arguably more important than Owen Farrell is to England. Just because he's Farrell's kind of presence on the pitch, he's got that ability. We know Johnny Sexton's abilities at this stage. And he does have this desire to go out on a high, because he's suffered so many World Cup disappointments himself. You know, he's been to three previous tournaments. And so he's driven. He and Farrell are quite the couple.
Pete, I was listening to that, and you're talking about the importance of Sexton, and we've talked about Farrell at length. Very briefly, watching that Scotland game, is Johnny Sexton more important to Ireland than Finn Russell is to Scotland? Because Russell is flourishing on that game line, and absolutely everything from Scotland is coming off this magician.
Yeah, I think what I noticed about Russell was on Saturday was that he was, as well as doing all that brilliant magician stuff on the gain line, he was also getting stuck into tackles and chasing back. You get the impression that this is definitely, it's his World Cup. It's in France. He has a French audience already, and he wants to, you know, he wants to be the star of that World Cup. You know, there seems to be a good relationship now between him and Townsend. I think Townsend going to his second World Cup, you're always a better coach when you've had disappointments and you learn your lessons and all that sort of thing. As to whether he's more important, I couldn't think of two fly halves really who would be more different temperamentally or stylistically, but they're on a par when it comes to their influence, definitely.
Well, I'll tell you what, guys, you've teed us up nicely to move on to the France-Scotland game, which probably was a bit of an antidote to some of the dirge of England-Wales. So after this, why don't we talk in more detail about France against Scotland?
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
So, yes, as we said, after England and Wales had served up a pretty dour spectacle at Twickenham, it was worlds apart, Stuart, in St Etienne, wasn't it? I mean, amazing atmosphere, a game that was won late, 30-27, all sorts going on, some unbelievable tries. Scotland with a bit of daring do as well, France playing in the way they do. You must have really enjoyed that.
I loved the game, but international rugby doesn't have to be the straight-jacketed game that England seem to have reinvented it as. You know, Twickenham, when England scored one of their driving forward tries, the noise I thought was huge, but I don't think it was. I think it was, there was silence throughout. Contrast that with what was bleeding out of my television Sunday morning from St Etienne, and there was a right to be excited, because it was a good game. It was a very interesting game as well. You know, I thought the previous week when Scotland won, it was a second stroke third French team. So you can't take much from it. And I think I said in the paper, if they beat France in St Etienne, that really will be a stunning result. And they nearly did. So what happened? Well, the fact that Scotland's first team played a week earlier meant that they were far less rusty. France haven't sent their big guns out until this week. And you could see it a little bit. And I thought they were blowing a bit in the last 25 minutes. So that might explain why Scotland got so close. But you have to give Scotland a lot of credit as well. Richie, I think he's got to stop talking to referees as much, but he's flourishing in every other way as a captain. He's magnificent. Scotland held on I think the fact that Aldegheri started and Antonio came off the bench helped, but the Scottish pack held on there in many ways. And just talked about it, Russell gives them a capacity to do literally anything. Tui Pulotu and Hugh Jones, who looked so poor for Glasgow against Toulon in the European Challenge Cup final, he makes them look world-class, and that is just how good he is. And when White comes back at scrum half, he's a very good player as well. Scotland have become not contenders to win a World Cup, but they've become very dangerous, as Pete has inferred, for either and both Ireland and France. So you saw this game and it just brought a smile to your face. From the French perspective also, you'd say Antoine Dupont was in third gear throughout and he still looked the best player in the world. His capacity to kick it vast distances off left to right foot is astonishing. His decision-making when to go left or right is equally good. And they've lost one of the most stylish players in the tournament in Entomac, but they have the most influential of that, there is no doubt. So huge amount of positives to take from that game, yeah. And thoroughly entertaining.
Did you see the bit where Dupont punctured the ball? He kicks it so hard that he deflated it. Did you see that? Blair King on caught it in the backfield, was just about to pass it, and then went, oh, hang on, there's no air in this ball. Just shows he's how powerful Superman. His boot is.
He's a superhero, Peter O'Reilly. What are your views on him?
Well, I'm interested to see how Antoine Dupont handles the pressure when it all kicks off. He seems impervious to injury and impervious to pressure, which is part of his genius. But one of the questions that you hear over here quite a lot of the time is, who would you prefer? Now, it's like, you know, who would you prefer Ireland to play in a World Cup quarterfinal, France or New Zealand? And it's a slightly presumptuous question because, you know, it presumes that that Ireland are going to get to that quarterfinal stage. But, you know, when Ireland came back from New Zealand last summer, having won a series out there, everybody would have said, oh, we'll take New Zealand again. But my feeling is that Ireland would be better off playing France. And one of the reasons being that it's a Six Nations match. It's one that Ireland have won as often as they have lost in the last 10 years. A lot of those young French players would have grown up, was looking up to some Irish teams, respecting them, not taking anything for granted against them. But I'm also interested to see how France handled the pressure. This, much more than 2007, is, you know, it's going to be the whole country behind them. Or on top of them, depending which way you look at it. They just lost one of their poster boys to injury. So the pressure comes even more onto Dupont now. I just thought there was just a hint of Fabien Galthié feeling pressure in his post-match comments after the Scotland game. He said, yes, Scotland pushed us close, but they are at a much further stage of their development because their domestic league finished in May and the top 14 didn't finish till the end of June. I'm thinking, you're playing New Zealand in 3 weeks, man. Like, yeah. So surely your preparation should be, you know, at a reasonable stage. I also, a French contact was telling me that Galtier, initially he wanted an easy tournament opener at the Stade de France. You know, he wanted to play one of the tier two teams, but it was the commercial department said, no, we're going to go for New Zealand. We need a big opening game here. But that, like 2007, when they lost to Argentina on the opening night, that could be a huge deflator for the whole country if they lose to New Zealand on the opening night. So I just thought Galtier's comments, you know, hinted at a certain amount of pre-match tension, if you like. So we'll see.
God, it's so exciting, isn't it? Like you mentioned Ireland and Africa earlier, Peter, and France, New Zealand, as much as we're all a bit depressed by watching England at the moment, there's so many good games that are coming up there, Stuart. It's going to be a brilliant World Cup, whatever England
do. And it's so hard to call. And, you know, we're all rightly saying, blimey, it's too lopsided. But it makes the pool stages and half the quarterfinals better than they've ever been at the World Cup. And I was listening to Peter there, and it's fascinating because I'm still thinking New Zealand are a country, the psychology of rugby is big there. And I think Ireland's run against them, not just the series, but the wins in Chicago and the wins in Dublin. I don't think New Zealand fancy Ireland at all. And I also think that Andy Farrell's confidence against New Zealand would blow through. I don't think, funnily enough, it wouldn't surprise me if New Zealand shocked France in the first game. But I think France have the capacity, the organisation and the squad to bounce back. I could see Ireland beating New Zealand in a quarterfinal and ending up playing France in a final. It's very hard because, you know, Ireland are going to have to beat South Africa and Scotland. But that, if you said to me, where would you go? I would be looking at New Zealand to shock France and then get taken out of the World Cup by an Ireland team that may just have been given a bit of a scrummage lesson by South Africa, but will learn and bounce back. So, I mean, it's, you know, this is supposition and it's wildest frenzied moments, but that's what people, how people are going to be thinking.
Yeah.
And to have those four, the, undoubtedly the best four teams in the world playing each other at this stage is incredible. It could scar it come the final. It probably will scar the semis, but a quarter final, my God, it's wonderful.
Well, we've got more matches coming this weekend. Wales have got South Africa coming, which will be interesting to see what sort of side South Africa bring. They're also then going to play New Zealand in a couple of weeks, which is a hell of a warm-up game to have for that week up from the World Cup at Twickenham. We've mentioned that Ireland are hosting England, Italy are playing Romania as well, and France are playing Fiji, while Scotland have a weekend off. I mean, Mark Palmer in today's paper was talking about the fact that they need to still cut four players. They're working out whether Ben White's going to be fit after an ankle injury. He's seeing a specialist today, it seems, on Monday. But yeah, they need to get rid of a tight head, a prop, a back row and a scrum half. So that's the thing with some of these other squads. They haven't been picked yet, whereas England went fairly early. Of those sets of games, Stuart, what are you looking for? A bit of, I don't know, it's hard to tell sometimes in these World Cup cycles where the box are at, because they kind of hide their first team, don't they? Is that intriguing, that one, Wales, South Africa?
Well, I think South Africa are going to play a different style of rugby. They're not going to be playing barbarians rugby, but I don't think in 2023 you'll see what they did in 2019. And for that reason, everyone is, you know, we're all assuming that Pollard will come back and that Razzie Erasmus has got his fingers all over it and it's a cunning plan. But Manny Libbok is if they want to use a spectacularly talented back three, as they seem that they want to do, Libbok gives you more than Pollard, who's played about four good games in a league that we're all saying England are struggling because the quality of the league's not good enough. But we want it both ways. You know, he's had a couple of good games for Leicester, so he's a world beater. That he hasn't played well for a long time. So that South African game, I want to see if they're combining this power game with some extravagant kicks to their wingers. I want to see whether Vilemza's going to be full back or the brilliant rugby brain of Willy Larue. That's a very exciting game. The other game that intrigues me is France. It's France-Fiji, isn't it?
Yeah, 8 o'clock Saturday night.
This week, France-Fiji, because much as I stay absolutely committed to thinking France will win this World Cup, I think after the Scotland game, they'll want to push on a bit. And I think with Wales and Australia in an intriguing pool, I want to see what Fiji can do against one of the best teams in the world. I'm really looking forward to that match.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, actually, we could maybe do a trailer, could we? I'm nodding over here to Alfie, the producer, because a special guest may be coming in a week or so's time that has links to Fiji, and you can probably guess who he is. But we'll leave that while hanging. And why don't we round up this episode of The Ruck with our God or Goddess of the Week after this. Right, guys, so God or Goddess of the Week time. Peter O'Reilly, why don't we start with you? Where are you going for your halo this week?
Well, I was tempted to go with Robbie Robertson, the guitarist and songwriter with the band who sadly died last week, but I know that Barnsley's going to go there. Dylan connection. So instead, slightly odd one, a little bit perverse of me, I'm going to go for Jack Dempsey, the Scotland number eight. He's not the most popular rugby player in the world based just purely on his selection for Scotland, based on the fact that he's already played for Australia, not just at 20s and schoolboy level, but he's actually played a good few times for the Wallabies. He's got a Glaswegian grandfather and he's made use of that that sort of technicality, which allows him to play for a second team. So I'm uncomfortable with the idea of somebody changing direction in their late 20s like that. But purely on his rugby playing ability, there was something godlike about him on Saturday night in Saint-Étienne. He is some athlete, the horse of a number eight who gives Scotland real go forward, but also, you know, he's skillful as well. I think he might be a bit of a missing link for them. So he's my God of the Week.
There you go. Stuart Barnes, didn't see many gods at Twickenham, did we?
No, we didn't, but Peter O'Reilly is a dangerous man. He can read my mind across the Irish Sea. Indeed, Robbie Robertson was the man I was thinking. Those guitar solos, those riffs, it makes no difference. Heartbreaking stuff. But I can't go for a non-rugby man because I am a conformist at heart. So I'm a conformist at heart. Therefore, I'm going to go rugby's non-conformist and go Finn Russell. Peter said it as well. I think he'll love playing in France where he's idolised. The courage of his game, the cool of his game, and the fact that he's gone from being a bloke who really doesn't want to bother with the time kicking goals. You know, he was a terrible goal kicker for a while and it caused Scotland no end of problems because they had to stick with Laidlaw because they didn't have another kicker. Now he's become such a rounded, brilliant rugby player that he's even prepared to do the sort of minutiae of the one-minute preparation, which is quite tedious. And, you know, he kicks goals, he makes breaks, he probably listens to the band in his spare time. So my God of the Week is Finn Russell.
There you go. Well, I'm going to stay with that same game, but I think I'll go to possibly one of the more obvious Gods of the Week. Will probably be one of the future gods of the week too, is Antoine Dupont. He's been maybe slightly quieter, possibly, for France. I mean, he's ludicrously high standards, but yeah, from deflating the ball to kicking off both feet, box kicking. He's actually making box kicking interesting by smashing them so far with both feet that he's people are actually keen to watch it. And also, yeah, just the support running. I mean, the way he was there running a dummy line for the Olivon try. Awesome. So welcome back, Antoine Dupont. He's a God of the Week. So there you go, everyone. Another Barack. We're going to try and maybe widen it out a bit next week and talk about some Celtic stuff. I know we haven't done loads on Wales, but they've got South Africa next week. So hopefully we can major on them next week. And then very quickly, we're going to be all off to the World Cup. So there'll be loads more, hopefully, from Peter as Ireland ramp to the World Cup. But for now, Peter, thanks so much for coming on. Hopefully see you again soon. I'll see you out in Dublin on the weekend.
Thanks, Will. Thanks for having me. And yeah, looking forward to seeing you here on Friday evening for a pint.
There you go, yes. And Stuart Barnes, pleasure as always. Thanks very much for coming on, Barnsley.
Thank you. Love speaking to everyone. Thanks for all your help, Alfie. Great seeing you, speaking to you, Pete, and you. Goodbye.
Perfect. And we've got an early reference there to our king producer, the great Alfie Reynolds. Thanks so much to him and also for you to listening. But that has been The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. Follow, subscribe, read the paper for all your own Farrell news and everything else this week. But for now, see you later and goodbye.